Good evening, everyone. Welcome to 2021 at the Poison Pen. This is our, well, actually not quite our kickoff event because Brad Taylor had a very nice event Tuesday night, January 5th, for American Trader. And we still have signed copies of Brad's book if you're interested. But this is our first in-store, well, sort of, virtual event with Chris Hattie and Nicholas Petrie. Now, I'm just so pleased to have them here because we've been fortunate enough to host their first books, and this is Chris's second book, but with Nick, I have to count, Nick. We have 1, 2, 3, 4, is this number 5 or number 6?
This is 6.
This is number 6. So Nick has been with us from his first book, The Drifter, which won multiple awards and which we loved, all the way up to the new book. And unfortunately, they're not quite here yet because Nick signed them back home in Milwaukee, but we will have our autographed copies of The Breaker in anytime. And Chris, who very kindly has signed for us his new book right here, Savage Road, which is the sequel to Deep State. So I think when we talk to Chris, you will be able to see his 30 plus years experience as a screenwriter come into play and the way he writes his novels. And Nick has, well, let's talk, Nick, for a minute. You have a slightly more checkered history in terms of how you got, didn't I put that well? How you got to publishing. So I do know that you have an MFA in fiction from the University of Washington and you won a short story award, but you know, how did you sort of drift into publishing?
Well, I am the, as a friend of mine said, the 25-year overnight success story. I wrote really by myself in my, you know, in my office or my basement or wherever. I was working as a carpenter and then a general contractor and then as a building inspector. And I wrote 3 books I couldn't get published. Each book got me a little farther along. My first book, I couldn't find an agent and I got some, a couple of really nice rejection letters and a couple of really, really mean rejection letters too, which I have kept. And framed. I hold a grudge. The second book I got, I found an agent who was not a very good agent and but at least it got read, but not accepted. The third book I found my current agent who is fantastic and a complete piece of work. And I got a very interested editor, but then that was right when the big crash happened in 08. And by the time I did the revision she asked for, publishers were no longer buying any books from some guy they didn't know. So then it, you know, it was finally my fourth book, which is The Drifter, which is the one that actually showed up and got published and has had a strange amount of success.
I wouldn't say it's a strange amount of success, but I particularly love the way that Nick and I got together because he was new and you can't always tell in a publishing house what book is going to have a lot of traction and what book isn't. I got a phone call one day saying, well, we have this book that's doing much better than we anticipated and we weren't going to send him on tour, but perhaps we could send him to see you in Scottsdale. And we said, fabulous. So that's how you got here. I've always been grateful that you weren't booked in like 9 other bookstores and we got that shot because otherwise, who knew? Now, Chris, you have a different story. Tell us a bit because you've got, as I said, something like 30 years of screenwriting under your belt. How different was it to write a novel after all of that?
It was very similar and very different. It was the first book that I tried writing. I hadn't written margin to margin prose since high school, writing short stories. You know, I had nothing to lose. So I tried anything that appealed to me and seemed interesting and exciting to me on the page. It was just a much more liberating experience than my screenwriting had been. But I did have my, you know, I certainly, you know, had a similar kind of 25 or 35 year overnight success as Nick, you know, because many years before I came out to Hollywood, and started getting paid as a screenwriter. I was a playwright in New York City. I was a poet in college, and then those short stories in high school. So it's been a long, long, always exciting, not always successful trudge to get to where I am today.
Well, delighted that you've gotten to two books in. I will mention that Deep State, Chris was here at the Poison Pen before the pandemic to sign Deep State, which was a first mystery book of the month, and The Drifter way back then, six books ago. I can't believe it's six books ago, Nick.
It still blows my mind, Barbara.
Right. I feel like a mom with a toddler sort of, blossoming into teenage years without my noticing. Anyway, it was also a first mystery book of the month for us. But I want to give a special shout out to the second book that Nick wrote, Burning Bright, which I still think has maybe the best opening scene for a thriller that I know of. And I always point it out to people who are looking about, how to write and so forth. It really is genius, Nick. So why don't you guys talk to each other for a bit, and then I'll step in with questions. But one of you'd like to lead off. Nick, what would you like to ask Chris?
Well, I was thinking about you as a screenwriter and reading, I guess, both your books. I was really struck by how much story there is in your stories, how much happens. And I was wondering if that's kind of a screenwriter's muscle, where you have to keep showing things. You have, because screenwriting is a visual storytelling medium. So you think that's a hangover from or something that you learned as a screenwriter to pack in so much?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think my DNA as a screenwriter is definitely evident in my books. I've said this many times before, but it's a challenge in Hollywood to get people to actually read. So you just have to pack that stuff in. You have to make the words count. Every word needs to count. And because the attention span is so short. And so I guess I probably am conditioned by that, but it's also, it's kind of, it speaks to also the kind of books that I've always enjoyed reading. I mean, I think a Elmore Leonard book, who's a real hero of mine, also kind of writes with that, plot heavy, fast read. And that's, that's just what I respond to as a reader. And that's what I'm going to write as an author, I think.
That makes sense.
Elmore
Leonard. Go ahead,
Barbara. I was just going to add that one of the reasons I think that Chris's books move so fast is that he writes in declarative sentences. He doesn't ornament things. And so I think that it's very propulsive, your writing style. I think it pushes people right along.
Yeah, I thought that I would just try and write the way that I've learned how to write over all these many years. And instead of trying to imitate, I'm a novelist now, I'm going to write like a great American novel or just how every other thriller writer whom I've read is writing. I just thought, like I said earlier, I've got nothing to lose. I'm writing this totally on a lark. I don't know the rules that I'm breaking, so just go for it. Also, just to kind of break some new ground. I mean, the way I have managed to hang around Hollywood as long as I have, is by always like going places where other people aren't playing, try and do familiar things in new ways. And that's how you keep people's interest, at least in Los Angeles. And so I thought, why not try it in New York and see how it works there? I think it's worked to some extent. So I'm continuing to try and, I'm only two books in. I've delivered the third manuscript. I think I'm developing those early ideas I sort of stumbled into, and I'm developing them more and taking new risks. I like taking risks as a writer.
Well, so one of the things that I like about your work too is you have these kind of grace notes where your heroine Haley Chill will have an encounter with somebody. And in this book, there's a moment on the metro where she there's just a walk-on character that she dragoons to put his hand to put pressure on somebody's injury. Mm-hmm. And then you give us like, so that the scene happens, and then you give us like a paragraph about what happens in the rest of this guy's whole life. And it's a tight, it's a clean paragraph, but it's this little sort of, and you know, it's, and how his life was impacted by this moment. And yeah. it's one of my favorite things that you do, but it also strikes me as the opposite of screenwriting, because you can't do that.
Well, you can't, and that was part of the liberation of writing books that I experienced in writing Deep State. But that also has some roots in my film background, because I always, one of the things I love at the end of some movies is when they tell you, I mean, a classic example is yeah. Animal House.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
What happened to these characters? You,
right.
You spend some time with them and you want to know what happens to Bluto when he, you know, 5, 10, 15 years down the line. And also it reflects on Haley too. It's like how, you know, what sort of impact did she have on this person that I'm ushering off the stage, whether it's,
right.
whether that character's only been there for, you know, a page and a half, or sometimes it happens to characters who've been, you know, in the majority of the book. You know, some people hate it. You know, some readers,
they're idiots.
They just, you know, you can't please everyone. But I would say the vast majority, 9 out of 10 readers, editors, booksellers, other authors, they seem to respond to it. And I don't think I've heard of anyone else who has said, oh yeah, you know, that's exactly what.
Yeah, I've never seen anybody else do it, which is why it stood out so strongly to me.
I'm waiting for my first imitator. I wanna see someone else do it so they can say, oh yeah, you got that from Chris Hoddy. Then I can like hang up my typewriter and consider it a resounding success. But Nick, I wanted to ask you a question a little bit about process and what Barbara was, you know, has mentioned a couple times, 6 books in. You know, I find it a challenge. I keep a copy of Deep State on my desk or Savage Road. I kept a copy of both books on my desk as I was writing the third book, just to remind myself of what did I do and does this work and am I contradicting something that I had already said before about this character or something that happened or any kind of biographical detail. 6 books, how do you keep it all straight in your head so that when you're working? Go ahead.
Yeah, it is a real challenge. I try to minimize the things I have to keep straight. Because for me, I want readers to be able to enter the series with any book. So if there's too much elaborate backstory, I might refer to one previous book. Usually there's a reference to the previous book, and it's a paragraph or two. It's sort of like what happened in Iceland, which was the and maybe that affects what's happening in this book, or maybe it doesn't. But it's a little bit of a mention to the previous. To the previous book, but you know, I don't want to have a lot of backstory. I've read books where as the series grows, the writer has to spend more and more time sort of filling in the story and giving all the background and the actual story in the book, the new story just gets slimmer and slimmer. And I really didn't want that to happen. Mm-hmm. I think as the series moves forward, you're populating it a little bit more, and there's more history. But I didn't want to have so many characters fill up. So my goal from the beginning is just to have those 3 recurring characters. There's Peter Ash,
right.
There's June Cassidy, his sweetie pie, and there's Lewis, who's his best friend. And if the thing gets too populated, if you have to have that same large cast of characters, then you have to develop longer backgrounds. You have to spend more time telling those stories, and it really interferes with telling the story that the book is really about.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't really have a formal Bible. There are writers who, you know, they've got a document where this is where he went to college and this is what his mom's name is. And I'm not that organized. Every book I sort of say, oh, I'm going to start one with this book, but I haven't yet.
Right. Or you get a Ryan Steck, you know, in your corner.
Right.
But Nick has done a good thing in this sense too, Chris, that every book is in a different location. So it's new to him and it's new to us. In fact, this book is really interesting because it's the first thriller I can think of that's set in Milwaukee. There must be another one somehow, but.
Well, the first book is set in Milwaukee.
But it's a
very different kind of story. And part of what's fun about writing a book set in a different place is you really have to choose the version of that place that you're telling a story about. So, you know, I wrote a book set in Memphis, and it's a book really about sort of the poor Black urban experience in Memphis. Mm-hmm. And I could have told a story about FedEx, which is headquartered there. And so there's all of this trade coming through. It's really a crossroads. So it could have been a book about smuggling. It could have been, it's on the Mississippi River, so it could have been a river story. So every place there are many different kinds of stories that you could tell. And it was fun to come back to Milwaukee because it's a different kind of story that I told the first time. And so it's another sort of view of this city where I live now and that I love.
Mm-hmm.
It's so funny. I totally forgot it was in Milwaukee. You were in Portland or somewhere.
Well, that brings up my second question for Nick, and not to make him do all the talking, but I like it when someone else does all the talking. Six books. This is an impossible question because it's like asking who your favorite child is. But I know of the three manuscripts I've written, which is my favorite, and I'm not going to say it right now, but I'm going to put it on you. Of your six published books, which, do you have a favorite? Do you have one that not necessarily you felt like you affected it most successfully or was the most successful, but just the one that really like got your inner chords humming and you just felt like this is it. This is the one that I really felt like everything came together.
Well, they all have things about them that are different that I love. Barbara mentioned Burning Bright, which was my second book, and I don't know that I have a favorite, but that what I loved about that one is that the Drifter took me 5 years to write,
mm-hmm.
and my publisher said we'd like to buy this book and we'd like a sequel in a year.
Mm-hmm.
And my wife, Margaret, just said, just say yes. And so I just said yes. And then I had to figure out how to do that. And I actually succeeded despite all of the sort of sleepless nights and sweating bullets and all those things. And so, you know, that's a particular favorite for that kind of reason. Mm-hmm. And also because it's where Peter meets June. So, mm-hmm. you know, this relationship, it's really a love story that's sort of has been flowing through this series. And that part of it was really a lot of fun to write. And it's still one of the things I like the best about writing this series is, you know, Peter and June and what are they to each other now and what are their conflicts? So I don't know that I would pick one, but that's certainly something I really like about that book.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Well, guys, we need to talk about the books just a little bit here, not, you know, to range around. So let me go back to Chris. I did want to add something to Nick's comment about the Haley meets somebody and then a whole picture develops. And one of the things I think I like so much about the way you do that, and which has certainly come home to roost in the last 2 days, is there are consequences. There are consequences to things that people do. And I really like the way you bring us to that point where you something happens and then you show us the consequences that may not be immediate, but may be longer range. And so I think that's really important, because I certainly have felt in the last day or two that people aren't thinking about consequences. They can get from A to B, but they can't seem to get from B to C or on. Mm-hmm. So I like that about the way you've done that we have a long tunnel. But let's talk for a moment, and I don't want to talk about politics, but I do think that and I don't want to give it away, but your basic premise, at least in Deep State and in this book, is that the President of the United States is not a person to be trusted, which is taking on extra relevance at the moment. But at some point, you're not going to be able to keep that up. So, I mean, this is, to me, Deep State and Savage Road are like two halves of the same story. But mm-hmm. at some point, you're going to have to do something different. So mm-hmm. tell us who Haley Chill is and, what's she doing? Because she's in a very interesting undercover role.
Well, Haley Chill is who she is because in the books so far, our leaders are so unreliable. And so she, the president and other authority figures in my stories are revealed to be something less than reliable. So she is the antithesis of that. She is very dependable, very reliable, very independent, and she's driven by a fairly simple, elemental dedication and belief in the US Constitution, very similar to the oath that every enlisted member of the US military swears to protect and uphold the US Constitution. Working with a character like that, she can have plenty of foibles and flaws, but if she's centered around something as, in my opinion, sympathetic and admirable as that, then I can convince my readers to follow her anywhere. So that's who she is in sort of a philosophical way. I don't know if you want me to tell you who she is in a biographical way, but she's a former member of the US Army who leaves the military. I don't think I'm giving away too much by talking about how she was recruited. Recruited by an organization that exists, it's really an organization that reflects those ideals that I just ascribed to her as someone who is very, a group that's very dedicated to the preservation of the ideals of the US Constitution. And their agenda is to keep our elected leaders and appointed authorities between the white lines, very much in the way that that we were not anywhere close to inside the white lines in the last 2 days or the last week. For me, she exists as a almost like a wish fulfillment or like almost like a childhood belief in Santa Claus or the Easter Bunny, someone who's going to be there, somewhat magical, somewhat mystical, but with pure intentions. That's who Haley Chill is.
And from West Virginia, and therefore not part of the Washington elite and so forth. So she's a great, She's a great central character. I will say, for those of you watching, I don't say this often, but I really do think you need to read Deep State before you read Savage Road. Otherwise, you
would, I think so. I don't know.
Going back to Deep State would be spoiled for you. So this is one where we highly recommend that you start with Deep State. And it's only two books. It's not like you're finding them at book 11, where it's or book six, which is more laborious. But in any case, I think Haley is a great character. And because she's centered in this job and because of who she is, other Washington figures can move on and she'll be there. And Nick, one of the things I really, really loved about this new book, The Breakers, I think is June's book. I mean, we've met June, and you're right, Burning Bright is the book where we met her. So I have to say Burning Bright is my favorite so far, just because A, the great opening scene, but B, it's because we meet June. But I thought you really unleashed her in this book, and she turns out to be not just a kind of an okay partner for Peter Ash, she's right out there taking the reins and is an even harder case than he is in this book. She's terrific.
Well, honestly, that's true of many of the women that I know, is that they are tougher than the men. That was sort of my goal, was to really give her a much larger role. And I really do think of this as much of June's book as it is Peter's. And I wanted to in this book to really, because they've been sort of dancing around this issue of who they are to each other. Right. And the challenges to this relationship, and what I wanted to do was to have them really confront that, and in this book that's sort of what they did, but June was the driver of that, and decisions that June made really were the, you know, kind of the driver of that as well, and I wanted, you know, I didn't want her to be the girlfriend, I wanted her to be, you know, really the main character, or as much of one as Peter.
Well, you know, in your way, you've done something that Parker did a little bit with Susan and Hawk. I mean, you could have Lewis and Peter and it could be a buddy book, and then June is just kind of, you know, a satellite character. Or it could be a romance with Peter and June, and then, you know, Lewis just sort of shows up from time to time when you need strong. He was kind of more like Bubba in the
Bubba Rogowski.
Yeah, in the Dennis Lehane thing. But this way, you've got a fully formed triangle. You've got, you know, three people, all of whom are important and all of whom are strong. So you're not trapped in either of those designs, but you've got a new thing going forward. And I thought, because she wasn't in the Iceland book, or barely in the Iceland book, you know, that was really Peter.
Well, and no Lewis in that.
No Lewis, yeah.
Either. Yeah, and so part of the goal for this book, I usually sort of set myself a couple of challenges or assignments for every book, and one of them for this book was that I wanted Peter and June to really show up on page one, June and Lewis to really show up on page one, and the way the book actually is typeset, they show up on page two, but in my Word document, it was page one.
Bad. Well, so we start out and they are, relaxing, having a beverage, and it looks as though we're going to have a mall shooting or a school shooting, but mall shooting. And, you know, then things don't go quite the way, because they never do in your books, the way that it looks, you know, at first blush. But I like the predicament that you have Peter in, which is that, you know, he's in disguise kind of, because he's a wanted man. So there he is in his baseball cap and his, you know, facial hair and the whole nine yards. And so he's going to have to do whatever he's going to do in this book sub rosa, because if he's identified, it'll be disastrous. But
right,
then you give him a carrot that he can follow, which is the chance of maybe getting a pardon, which pushes him into doing things. So I think your setup on this was really very well thought of.
Well, I wish it was something that I planned out. It's as with most of my books, they just sort of, I begin and they sort of, sort of show up in dribs and drabs. Actually, Chris and I talked about this last week about he's appalled that I don't, you know, plan a book out ahead of time. And I can't imagine working the way he does. So.
Well, it brings new meaning to your trepidation for book two when you had spent 5 years sort of flying by the seat of your pants with the first book, and then to do that in the second book, which I haven't read, but I'm going to take Barbara's word for it, certainly. It must be a good one. That's impressive. I mean, again, it's like we're come from different planets. We do the same thing, but we do not come from the same worlds. I couldn't imagine.
Well, they're very distinct. They're very distinct methodologies, and I know people working who work both ways. Mm-hmm. And Jason Pinter actually said something. We were on a panel together, and Jason Pinter said that he's a pantser, meaning he's a seat of the pants writer, mm-hmm. until he needs to become a plotter. And then he's a plotter until he needs to become a pantser again. And to me, that was really the best description of how I work. I start with a situation and I write forward. And then at a certain point, I have to like sort of stop and say, okay, where the hell am I? What am I trying to do? I have to sort of take a step back and evaluate what I've done and think about what all the components are and you know what the ramifications are with the directions it might go. And so then I can take that, you know, sort of little analysis piece, and I can launch myself forward for the next bunch until it stops working. And then I have to go kind of wing it again for a while. What is it that Churchill said about democracy? It's the worst form of government except every other one. Like for me, it's the only way I can work. I wish it were more organized, but that's kind of the only way it works for me.
Well, with the third book, which I've just finished the first draft of, you know, I started out, and again, I had outlined it, of course, and I had started out thinking that one character was going to be, essentially, being as vague as possible, a bad guy. It's definitely going to be a bad guy. And then I just realized that I like this character. the way I had written them, I was like, I kind of like this guy, you know, and I really don't want him to be a jerk. And so after, I don't know, maybe about 10,000 words or 15,000 words, I changed. I decided this is going to be a good person, a good guy. And I love the character. It turned out really well, I think. But I did have to go back and you know, retread. So do you have, I mean, I'm a twisty guy, but you have twists and turns in your books. I mean, I know how sometimes not all my twists are planned. And I know sometimes, like I said, I have to go back, but do you just sort of see a potential for a twist as you're approaching it, and do you have to go back and retread what you've done to fix it?
Sometimes, you know, the funny thing to me is that if I don't think about it too much, I get to the end of my draft, and then I sort of look back and I see all of the things that I laid in there not really meaning to. So much of the work is done somewhere in the back of my brain, which is a much smarter storyteller than I actually am in person. And so a lot of it, you know, something I'll go for a walk and something will just show up.
Right.
There's a character in this book named Edgar, who is a particularly peculiar individual, I guess I would say. And Edgar, I never thought Edgar was sort of a placeholder. He was sort of a device.
Mm-hmm.
I needed someone threatening, but I didn't really know what he was doing there or what he was like.
Mm-hmm.
And then I needed to know a little bit more about him. And so I started writing in the third person about him. And then suddenly it was Edgar's voice.
Mm-hmm.
And I was inside of Edgar's head, which is a strange place to be, by the way. Edgar was a lot of fun to write. But that's kind of how things often happen for me, where I just sort of get started. It's a lot like improvisation, mm-hmm. or performance art or something like that for me, which is kind of a weird way to think about writing crime
mm-hmm.
fiction.
Mm-hmm.
And often I don't, you know, I don't really understand the emotional content of a scene until I've gone through it a couple of times. And I'm like, why isn't this working? Oh, because this is what's actually happening. Mm-hmm. It's not the thing that the front of my brain thinks is happening. It's what the back of my brain, it finally figures out what I'm supposed to be doing. Mm-hmm. So it is not an efficient process. And that there is a lot of back and forth. There's not a lot of rewriting. Usually I just sort of, I write until it sort of stalls out, which tells me that the idea I had for what's going to happen next isn't the right idea.
Well, so if it's all right with Barbara, can I ask Nick one more process friendly question?
You don't need any help from me, by the way.
I know. I'm just curious. I'm curious from this strange beam from another planet. So when you, I know a little, we did have a talk before this talk, and I do know, like a lot of writers and a little bit like me, you before you get to the new days words, you go back and read some of the work from the prior couple days, correct? That was you, right?
Yeah.
So when you work all the way through to the end, and you know, it's like, it's not the end because we only do that in screenplays, but you finish.
I always write the end.
Just because it's so satisfying.
Good. Yes.
But so when you've gotten through that form of the manuscript, how much, because you're a pantser and not outliner, how close are you to sending it, delivering it?
2 weeks.
To your editor.
Yeah. Well, because I'm always, when I get stuck, I go back, I often will go back to the beginning and I'll work my way through.
Right. So lot of editing and polishing as you write the first time.
On the fly. And if I have things are moving along, but I know I need to change something 15 chapters back, I'll just make a note in the manuscript, all caps.
Yeah.
You know, June needs to this, that, or the other, so that I don't kind of lose the rhythm. And then every time I go back through, I find those notes I've left to myself, and I make those changes, and the book becomes a little more itself.
Yeah.
But the end, truly, the end of my first draft is really almost my final draft, because then all I have to do is go back through the last, 20,000 words worth of notes.
Yeah.
And then, run spell check and, change, make sure I've spelled the guy's name the same way every time. And there was a lot of that with the Iceland book. Those names are crazy.
Yeah, that's tough.
Good point. Let me just check with Patrick and see if we have any questions. Do we, Patrick?
There are just a few.
All right, Patrick will speak up now.
Let's see. Well, just a couple of basic questions for both of you. Where do you get inspiration for your characters, plots, and stories?
That's basically where do you get your ideas thing. Right. Well, which we've kind of talked about. I think Peter Ashe is an interesting character. Nick, we haven't really talked about his having PTSD and how claustrophobia is part of, certainly in The Drifter, where he's like living under a porch. And when we first meet him is, important to understand his psychology. So part of your ongoing story with Peter is bringing him out of that, or at least letting him learn to live with it, right?
Yeah, when I first started writing about veterans, I'm not a veteran myself, so it's not personal experience, but I've spoken with many, many veterans about their lives after war. And that's really how this started, was how do you recover from the most powerful and possibly shattering experience in your life? How do you come home from war and put your life together? And what I realized very quickly was that post-traumatic stress, if you've really got a bad case, never goes away. The war, and regardless, if you've been in combat, the war never leaves you. You always remember that. I've talked to men who fought in Vietnam who still wake up covered with sweat in the middle of the night. This is, it's sort of a cliche, but it really does happen. And so part of what I wanted to do, but there are things that help. And part of the challenge for veterans is that it's a culture that doesn't really ask for help. It's a culture that's about sucking it up and being strong and moving forward. But there are really simple, basic things that can make a huge difference. And part of what I wanted to show was how Peter can move forward. What are the things that he does? What does his life begin to look like as he begins to reassemble and imagine what this next life is going to be? And so my goal was to sort of show him getting better along the way, to better at working it out and to watch him pushing his own limits. And then I have a good friend who was in Vietnam who had a pretty major relapse of post-traumatic stress in his 70s because of a horrible incident in his life. And that, again, I had more conversations with more veterans, and it's not a smooth process. So the wild one really is Peter has a relapse and he's off in a strange place. He's by himself. So it's a man against nature book, and it's a man against himself book, which is really what man against nature books are. And so to me, that's an interesting thing to write about, but it's also something that talking with readers who aren't veterans, who haven't been through this, readers really identify with just the struggle to manage the difficulties in their own lives. And we're all a little crazy, right? We're all suffering in our own ways about our own things. And I think that's part of why Peter has struck a chord with so many people, is that we watch him do battle with these demons of his with a sense of humor and with courage and with setbacks. But he's the person we all would like to be, fighting forward to reclaim the lives that we want.
Right. So you basically have a capable person who's been damaged, and a great deal of what you're writing about is his journey, moving away from that. Chris, on the other hand, is an interesting contrast because he has Haley, who, comes out of West Virginia and is not damaged and is going to be dealing with people who are. So it's interesting. The two of you are kind of antithetical in that one sense. Oh.
Yeah, she has to deal with the biases, against her upbringing, her right. Gender. There's a general, I think, in some quarters at least, a bias against former military people. Her struggles are in some manners imposed upon her. The flaws I and struggles I wanted to give to her, her personal ones that are her own doing, I wanted them to be more generally identifiable for a person of her age and some extent her background. But it's really a matter of her. I guess her biggest struggle, her personal struggle, is to be able to have a normal life given the job I've assigned her. I think you can reduce that more to just kind of simple, I think a highly relatable issue for everybody, which is how do I take time away from my job, my profession, my goals, and take care of myself and my family and friends. So that's kind of a very basic issue that I hope resonates with everybody who reads right. The books.
So you picked Washington, D.C. as the theater for Haley, at least so far. And Nick has chosen Milwaukee twice. But other theaters. So it all kind of grows out of who the character is and what you want to, what story about them that you want to tell. Patrick, is there another question?
Here's a question. Pat asks, have you ever had a side character who that develops into a villain?
Was that side character who develops into a villain? That's a great question.
Yeah.
How about you, Chris?
Well, I only have a couple books in my on my belt, but
you do.
You
do, but I don't want to give it away. We meet him in the first book.
Right. Yeah, I mean that's the kind of fun of it, is like being able to go places where, you know, you least expect. So yeah, certainly.
It's funny for me. It's not that, but I have villains that turn into more sympathetic characters, and some of them remain villains and some of them don't. That was how Lewis started. Lewis started out as sort of the local warlord in Milwaukee. And I didn't really see that happening. It wasn't something I planned. It wasn't something, but he just was so interesting that he kept showing up. And,
yeah, I was going to ask you, because I've only read The Wild One and The Breaker. Which is fine. You didn't tell us how they met. Unless I missed that part, but the origin of their friendship wasn't established, which I think is fine, because, you know, laying that pipe in a book every time you with each book in the series would get tiresome for people who read all your books.
Well, and I could also, I mean, it may or may not be in this book, but usually I'll give a sentence about how they met.
Uh-huh.
Or something like that. But I don't think you really need to do much more. One of the funny things about this book is I sent an advanced copy to a friend, a PDF to a friend, and he said, "Oh, it's so great to see Peter and June and Lewis all back together." And I don't read these books as a reader, right? I'm a fan of other books. I'm a fan of other series and other writers and other novels, but that's not my relationship to these books. Mm-hmm. And it was a really vivid reminder that other people have the relationships to my books that I have with other books. Mm-hmm. And I try really hard not to think about what some people call fan service, right? You have to have a certain kind of thing because the fans like to see this kind of thing. You know, the Marvel movie franchise people worry a lot about this kind of stuff because those characters have such a long history. And I try not to worry about that. But I always, something sort of always shows up, some little piece of something. So it's again, I think it's kind of the DNA of series fiction that I mean, I've developed this affection for these characters and just like readers do, and to be able to sort of play with some of that stuff a little bit.
I'm curious how you answer this question that I get almost at every event and at least once a week on Twitter. And that is, who would you cast for your three main characters?
You know, I really don't think about it. I get that question all the time, and I'm usually pulling some character out of my head. I am not someone who keeps a lot of track of Hollywood.
Right.
So I'm not sure I actually have a satisfying answer for that.
Well, I wasn't so curious as to who you would answer as how you would answer.
I used to anticipate the question and think about it ahead of time, and I've sort of stopped.
Yeah. I can't remember which author, you know, like I said, I haven't been at this game very long, but early on, I was asked the question, and Deep State's been in development, not in development, it's been optioned for a couple of years, and very early on, there was discussion of some names, and like you, I don't really know the names that I should know that are currently on, you know, on the
because we're over 30.
Exactly, probably over 25, but You know, I think I threw out a couple ideas, and fans had thrown out a couple ideas, and I'd have to go and Google the names. I go, yeah, that she looks pretty good. That would be right. But I heard this other author, I can't remember who it was, but he said, you know, I used to always answer that question, and then I would piss off certain fans because they had a completely different idea in their head, and they would argue with you. It's sort of like the idea of like when you tell friends the name of the baby you're going to have in 3 or 4 right. months, and right. they say that's a terrible name. So I always cite that anonymous author when I'm asked that question of like, Dad, you know, whoever sounds good to you is good by me.
Yeah. And well, it's interesting. Early on, there were conversations with Bradley Cooper's people. Mm-hmm. And I would have been very happy to have Bradley Cooper play Peter Ash. And this was right after he did American Sniper.
Mm-hmm.
And then Michael B. Jordan, who is the boxer in Creed and
Fruitvale Station, I think. He did Fruitvale
Station. Fruitvale Station was his first, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
He was the villain in the Black Panther movie. And he's a fantastic, I mean, he's a movie star, but he's also really an actor. And so his people had asked if it was okay if they flipped the race on everybody so that Peter was black. Hmm. And I was like, that would be really cool. Like, I would be up for that. I think that would be really interesting. Mm-hmm. It'd be a different take.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, and there's still nibbles and, you know, I'm not holding my breath.
The good news is long form television is sucking up everything it can because that's what people are doing. So your chances of seeing Peter or Haley are probably higher right now than they would have been last year when we talked. So
right.
Patrick, anything else?
Well, a lot of the people that are watching are saying that, you know, you are both new authors to them and they're looking forward to reading your work. I do have a question from Wendy who asks, which authors have inspired you and which are your current favorites?
Well, you know, Chris talked about Elmore Leonard and he's no longer with us, but he was a very big deal in the mid to late 80s and into the mid 90s and really wrote until the year he died, which was five or six years ago, maybe. He wrote Get Shorty, among other things. I mean, he was a huge influence on me, both because of the speed, and it's really his wit and his dialogue for me are kind of the gold standard. Mm-hmm. So he was a huge influence on me.
And
Robert Parker, those early Spencer books especially, because there's the character is so rich and they are so thoughtful. And a lot of people talk about sort of the Spencer Hawk dynamic with Peter and Lewis, and it certainly wasn't something I did on purpose, but I've read that whole series, which is, I don't know, 40 books or something. I've read each of those at least 3 times. That's has been comfort food for me for many years. So those are kind of past influences for sure. So who else for you, Chris?
For me, you know, commercially it was definitely Elmore Leonard, and I think there was such a kind of a shared sensibility between the movie world, which is what I've, you know, really have been saturated in up until the last 2 years for 3 decades. But you know, I like to read, I think we discussed this the other night, I like to read outside the genre to just, that's what inspires me. And so, I mean, it sounds completely conceited or obnoxious or both to say, but like if I read, I'll read some Cormac McCarthy before starting a new book just to kind of like feel like this is, you know, these are, every word seems to have a reason for being on the page. And that's what I aspire to. Or going all the way back to those short stories I mentioned in high school 10 or 15 years ago. You know, Ernest Hemingway was a huge influence. I was constantly writing, trying to write like him because it was so, you know, to a simple high school junior, it seemed doable, not realizing how difficult it is to actually write like Ernest Hemingway, and not just kind of look like it on the page. But again, I mean, that I feel like that's still kind of filtering through to what I write today, of trying to keep things as simple and clear and understandable as possible for my readers.
Well, and something too that, I mean, Hemingway was kind of the first writer I was taught in school that mm-hmm. really resonated with me.
Mm-hmm. I don't know why. I'm sure there's many reasons, but it's perfectly understandable. Yeah. I mean, it's just great yeah. reading material. You know, yeah. forget about literature. Well,
and he wrote war stories and love stories.
Yeah.
And I mean, he wrote very kind of elemental stuff as well. And the thing I think that you and I both do is that's very much Hemingway, really. I don't know if he was a pioneer of it, but he strongly identified with this, where the emotion is really right below the surface. It's really not something that's mentioned,
yeah.
but it really comes through in the sentences, in the language.
Yeah.
And I think that's really one of the, in crime fiction, really one of the legacies of Hemingway for sure.
Yeah. Yeah.
Very well said. So gentlemen, we're going to leave with the...
What? Are we done?
Well, it's been an hour, which is just flown. I love it that it has. I always like to leave your fans and new readers and so forth with the thought that there will be a new book coming, because, you know, you're already at work, or in some cases finished with the next book, even though this is the one we're currently seeing. So you wrote to me, Nick, that your move, what is it, The Wilds of Nebraska is going to be the set for the next Peter Ashe?
It's set in Nebraska, and it is a tale of sex, obsession, jealousy, and murder.
Whoa, in Nebraska.
Wow. I don't have anything prepared like that.
Yep.
Nick knew that this question was coming.
Here's a pro tip. That's always the last question.
That's pretty good. I've finished, I think I've mentioned it a couple times already, the third book in the series. And Barbara, I do escape the swamp of DC for book three. We start out there, and then we get Haley out to West Texas.
Excellent.
I really love the book, and I've from the get-go, from the outlining stage, I thought of it as sort of my Alice through the Looking Glass. So Haley's gonna get put through her paces, and it's occasionally dark, but I think ultimately quite redemptive.
No.
That is a wonderful
off the cuff
preview for us. Thank you so much. I love that. Gentlemen, it's really been a pleasure, and I'm happy to see that you're just as compatible as I suspected you might be when we set this up.
Great.
So thank you for spending time with us. We always appreciate it. For those of you who have been watching, if these authors are new to you, I recommend, well, you can plainly tell I'm crazy about both of them, so I certainly recommend them. Don't forget, we have autographed copies of Deep State and The Breaker coming.
Savage Rogue.
I'm sorry, you're right. I'm looking at the back of the book. Well, we did have a lot of copies of Deep State, but we actually sold them. So it's Savage Rogue and The Breaker. And good news is we'll do this again with their next books. And if you haven't read their earlier books, Nick's earlier books, I certainly recommend that you give them a shot. So happy New Year, guys. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And thanks for having us, Barbara.
Hopefully next year, Barbara, we'll see you in person there.
I know.
I certainly hope so. We'll see. I got a word today from the Mayo Clinic about vaccinations and so forth. So we can begin to see some things rolling out. And perhaps with politics absorbing less of our energy in the coming year, you know, people will be more attuned to other things around them. I do have to say that for anybody writing thrillers, none of you could have imagined this week.
No.
I try, but.
Just could not have. So it's a high bar for people writing fiction to follow. Maybe true crime is going to be, you know, the genre of choice for the next year or two. It's really been wild. In any case, thanks, guys, and good night.
Thank you. Thanks, brother.
Thank you.
Hello. We hope you're enjoying our programs and podcasts with authors. We'd like to expand them, and your help would be appreciated. Please make a donation at poisonedpenfoundation.org. 100% of the proceeds will go to help connect authors with readers in this difficult time. Thank you.